This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of The Hideaway by Lauren K. Denton, published by Thomas Nelson and read by Carthy Masters.
Chapter 1. Mags. March. Sunsets in Sweet Bay have always made me feel a little like a child. I think it's all that vast open water. I expect something to come rising out of the deep at the last minute, something huge and unexpected. I'm always waiting, anticipating, but each night is like the one before, a frenzy of color, the disappearance of the sun, the dusk settling in like an old friend getting comfortable. Earlier this evening, when I left the house to come out here to the garden, Dot was standing by the microwave, waiting for her popcorn, while Bert washed his cast-iron skillet with just the right amount of gentleness. Business as usual. We'd had a pleasant dinner, good food, lively conversation. But everyone knows, after dinner is my time in the garden. They stopped asking me long ago to join them in their nightly routines. A television drama, a jigsaw puzzle, Glory laying out her quilt squares. Late evenings belong to me in my memories. I sit here on my old bench, made by hands that once held mine. The bench isn't much, just cedar planks and peeling paint. But it's been a friend, a companion for almost as long as I've lived in this house. My fingers curl under the edge of the bench, a habit formed over the years. I close my eyes and breathe in deep. So much has happened. Sometimes it hurts to think on it all. Other nights, like this one, the memories are sweet. Next to me is the latest issue of Southern Living that came in the mail today. Sarah and her shop are featured on page 50. I like having her photo close. This way I can pretend she's sitting here next to me. Just as I'm about to open the magazine, I get that hitch in my chest again, a tightness, like a little fist squeezing closed, then a fluttering, then it's gone. I reach down and pull off my shoes so I can feel the dirt under my toes. That always makes me feel better. My doctor suggested I wear these ridiculous white orthopedic walkers, even though I much prefer my old rubber boots. Good Lord, I love those things. They were practical, hard-working. Same with the waders and hats. You can't fix a busted boat motor or change the oil in a truck wearing a fussy dress and tearing heels. My Jenny never seemed to mind my get-ups. She felt right at home in our unconventional life. But Sarah was a different story. I saw how she looked at me, like she wondered how in the world her grandmother, not to mention a house as grand as the Hideaway, could have turned out so strange. I've wondered from time to time whether I should sit Sarah down and tell her my story. By the time she moved in with me, she was already at that tender point in every young girl's life, where friends' opinions mean more than anything else. And I knew my existence in her life didn't help her climb the ladder of popularity. But I always wished I could find a way to help her see the Hideaway in me in a different light. Truth be told, I think she's a stronger woman now because of who I turned out to be. If I'd remained under my parents' thumbs, always worrying about how others perceived me, I would have been a wispy shadow of a real woman. And I have to think that somehow my refusal to bow to the norms helped shape Sarah, even if she hasn't consciously realized it. Maybe the time is now. She's no longer a fickle teenager, but a grown woman, and a smart one, too. She'd do well to know my story, know how it changed me from quiet to bold, weak to strong. I'll tell her. I'll sit her down and tell her everything. One of these days. Chapter 2. Sarah. April. I love the smell of New Orleans in the morning. Even now, the city's detractors say it smells like last night's trash or the murky water dripping into the sewer drains, but I know better. It's the smell of fish straight from the Gulf. Not stinky, but briny and fresh. It's the aroma of just-baked French bread wafting through the quarter from Frenchman Street, It's the powdered sugar riding the breeze from Café du Monde. Sure, there's the tang of beer and smoke and all the sin of Bourbon Street, but when you mix it up together, the scent is exhilarating. I walked out of the front door of my loft at 9:15 and inhaled the crisp air. It was April, which in New Orleans and anywhere else in the Deep South could mean anything from 80 degrees to 40, depending on the whims of God and the Gulf jet stream. This day had dawned cool and bright. Instead of slipping into my Audi, I walked to the corner of Canal and Magazine to catch the bus to my shop. It was more of a walk than I preferred to do in wedge heels, but Alan was always telling me I needed to break out of my routine and do something unexpected. I smiled. He'd be proud of me for ignoring the time and my feet and enjoying the morning. After all, no one would mind if we opened up a little later than usual. In the Big Easy, businesses were always opening up late or closing early for one reason or another. It wasn't the way I preferred to operate, but it was the way of life here, and I'd gotten used to it. "Hey there, pretty lady," a deep tenor voice called out from the shady depths of Three George's Jewelers. This George was always trying to hawk CZ jewels and faux baubles to unwitting tourists. I never bought into George's ploys, but I couldn't avoid him. He was too charming. "Hi, George. Planning to cheat anyone out of their hard-earned dollars today?" "All day long, my dear. One of these days you'll have one of my beauties shining on your finger. Send your beau my way and I'll set them up with something perfect." "I'm sure you would, but there's no beau for me today." "A pretty lady like you? I'm shocked." He called everyone a pretty lady, even some of the men. I wound my way through the quarter to where the bus picked up shoppers and business owners and shuttled us to the middle of Magazine Street. Everyone I encountered was in a jovial mood, and I remembered why I fell in love with New Orleans. As I twisted the key in the lock at bits and pieces, balancing a tall to-go cup of coffee in the crook of my elbow, Alan roared into the driveway on his Harley. "You're late," he gracefully dismounted the bike. "Pull an all-nighter like me?" His Hollywood starlet shades covered half his face. His hair was orange today. "No, I didn't, thank you. You're one to talk. You're late, too." "Can't make an entrance if I'm always on time." He hopped up the front steps and grabbed my cup of coffee just before it slipped from my arm. I pushed the door open, and the welcome scent of gardenias drifted past us. We carried a line of hand-poured soy candles in the shop with such pleasing fragrances. Light, not overpowering. I designed bits and pieces to make people want to stay for a while. We even kept a Keurig in the back and pralines in a dish by the cash register. I was in love with everything I tucked into the old shotgun house, from restored furniture to antique silver to vintage linen pillows embroidered with the ever-present fleur-de-lis. I'd found much of it at antique markets and estate sales, even a few garage sales. I didn't limit myself to specializing in one particular type of item. That's why I named it Bits and Pieces, a little bit of everything. Invigorated by the sunshine and the freshness of the spring air, I propped open the front door and we began the day. I set the music to Madeline Peru while Alan tinkered with one of the vignettes he'd set up in the side room. In deference to his constant harping that I needed to allow a bit of Southern goth into the shop to appeal to the legions of Anne Rice and voodoo fans in the city, I gave him some leeway. I figured New Orleans had enough mix of high and low, uptown and downtown, that I needed to relax my rules a bit. However, I did draw the line at voodoo dolls. Instead, he scattered tiny white porcelain skulls throughout the shop. Several of my customers bought them to use as unconventional hostess gifts. The day went on as it usually did. Being the middle of the week, most of the customers breezing in and out were locals. Weekends were for the tourists. A few regular clients had hired me to redecorate their houses, and one popped in to show me photos of sideboards she wanted me to look for the next time I went scavenging. A student from the New Orleans Academy of Fine Art brought by a selection of framed photographs for me to display. Alan picked up sandwiches from Guy's Po' Boys. As we neared closing time, Alan ducked into the back office to check a few voicemails that had slipped in while the shop was busy earlier in the day. After a moment, he motioned to me from the hallway. "Some lawyer called. He said he needs to talk to you about a Mrs. Van Buren," he shrugged. "Asked you to call him as soon as you can." It had been over a week since I talked to Mags. We usually talked on Sunday afternoons, but I'd missed our last call because of a water leak at the shop. Instead of hearing the latest Sweet Bay gossip, I'd spent the entire day with buckets, soaked towels, and a cranky repairman. By the time I made it back home and showered, it was too late to call. She left a message on my phone the next morning, but we had yet to catch up with each other. My customer glanced at me, then at his watch. Not wanting to appear distracted, I shook my head. "I'll have to call him back a little later." "Sure thing, boss." As the customer slowly circled the shop, scratching his chin and considering his purchase, I fought a strange urge to jump in my car and drive back to Sweet Bay to see Mags. I laughed under my breath at the impulsive idea. I couldn't just drop the strings holding my life together and take a break. But I still longed to hear her voice with a force that surprised me. An hour later, after selling the circa 1896 dining table and packing it into the back of the truck, we finally closed for the day. All I could think about was calling the lawyer. Maybe Mags had gotten herself into hot water with someone in town. I smiled at the thought. It wasn't out of character for my grandmother, but wouldn't she want to tell me about it herself? Or, at the very least, Dot could have called to fill me in. Why would a lawyer call for something trivial? Alan and I stayed at the shop until 7, checking the register, straightening furniture, and tidying up in preparation for the next day. I often didn't leave until much later, but I headed out early with him. "Want a lift back to your place?" he asked when we paused in the driveway. "I have an extra helmet." "Thanks, but I think I'll take my time getting home. I still have to call the lawyer back." "Right. What was that all about?" "It's Mags. Van Buren is her last name." "Ah, Mags from Sweet Bay, Alabama," Alan attempted an exaggerated southern drawl. "Impressive last name for your eccentric little grandmother." He was quiet for a moment. "Lawyers don't usually call with good news, boss." He fit his helmet over his head. "I've already thought of that." "Did she mention anything when you talked to her on Sunday?" "I missed the call. I was here with Butch and the gaping hole in the roof, remember?" I pinched his elbow and he pinched me back. "I still don't understand why you don't go back to Sweet Bay more often, or why not bring her here for a visit sometime. I make a killer white Russian. Don't old people like those?" I laughed. "I have no idea if she likes white Russians, and I do visit. I told you all about my Christmas trip. Bert almost burned down the tree trying to decorate it with lit candles. Mags had to douse it with the fire extinguisher. It was total chaos as usual. Our Sunday phone calls work just fine." "Maybe for you. I bet Mags would love to see your face more often. Who wouldn't?" He patted my cheek and slung one leg over the seat of his motorcycle. "It's not like you have to make a cross-country trip to get there." I bit the inside of my cheek and glared at him, but he was right. I may have left Mags in my small hometown for the greener pastures of New Orleans, but Mags was my only family. I owed her more than I'd given her. "Okay, okay, I'll shut up. Go ahead and make your phone call. I'll see you tomorrow." Alan lifted his helmet to give me a quick kiss on the cheek, revved the engine a few times, and sped away. Instead of heading for the bus to take me back to Canal, I took a left on Napoleon and walked towards St. Charles. On the way, I pulled out my cell and thumb-swiped to my voice mailbox. 5 or 6 unanswered messages stared up at me from the bright screen, Mags included. She'd rambled on about nothing in particular, so with the ongoing roof problem that week, I hadn't made time to return a call. I touched her name on the screen, and the sound of her voice filled the air around me. As I heard it a second time, the tone of her voice struck me as unusual. I must not have noticed it before because of the chaos surrounding the water leak, but she didn't sound as chipper as she usually did. Just after she gave me a rundown of the squirrels uprooting her geraniums and the bats in the chimney at the hideaway, she paused and sighed. I know it's not a holiday, or even close to one, but I'd love to see you, dear. Sometimes the sight of your face is all... Well, she cleared her throat and laughed a little. Things are busy over there, I know. It's not like I'm going anywhere, so you just come whenever you can. Don't change your plans for me. Her message finished just as I approached the handful of other folks waiting for the streetcar in St. Charles. I sat on a bench away from the group and fiddled with my phone, switching it from hand to hand. I wanted to call Mags, to check on her, to apologize for not calling earlier, but something compelled me to call the lawyer first. I pushed the button, and my stomach knotted as I waited. Ah, Miss Jenkins, thank you for calling me back. I was just about to walk out the door. I heard him settling back down in his chair. Then a file folder slapped the desk. I'm Vernon Baines, Mrs. Van Buren's lawyer. Has anyone contacted you? No, what is this about? I asked, ignoring the gentle sadness in his voice. Your grandmother passed away this morning. I'm sorry to be the one to tell you, but Mrs. Ingram didn't feel she could handle speaking about it yet. She asked if I would break the news to you. I closed my eyes and turned my back to the other people waiting for the streetcar, then covered my eyes with my free hand, pressing my temples until it hurt. You'll be happy to know she didn't suffer. She complained of some chest pain, so Dot brought her into the doctor. They couldn't have known it before, but Mrs. Van Buren was at the beginning of what turned into a major heart attack. The doctor called for an ambulance, but she died on the way to the hospital. Dot said it looked like she just closed her eyes and fell asleep. I thought of the streetcar rumbling down the tracks toward me as it picked up and deposited people at various points on the line. 3.5 more minutes and it would stop for me. I cleared my throat and sat up straighter on the bench. Thank you for calling, Mr. Baines. I appreciate you letting me know. We'll have a reading of the will on Friday afternoon here at my office. And where is that? I'm in Mobile, just across the bay. Chapter 3, Sarah. April. That night, I took a glass of wine into the courtyard. My building and several others on the block, all duplexes formed out of circa 1850 carriage houses, backed up to a small patio ringed by bougainvillea, sweet jasmine, and palms. Someone had stuck a wrought iron table and a jumble of chairs in the middle, creating an open area in the lush oasis. On nights when the humidity wasn't 200%, a cluster of neighbors and friends of all ages and varying degrees of quirkiness congregated to toast the end of another day. On this particular evening, Millie and Walt, the couple who lived in the other half of my duplex, were staring each other down across a chessboard. Everyone knew better than to disturb them until one, usually Millie, cried, "Checkmate." I settled down into a glider and took a slow sip of Cabernet. I had roughly 40 hours before I needed to head east on I-10 toward Alabama. I'd have to start early the next morning to move appointments, make phone calls, and write notes for Alan. He'd probably resent me for assuming he couldn't do my job alone for the week, but I couldn't help it. The shop was my baby, and I didn't take lightly leaving it even just for a few days. I pulled out my phone to check the time. 8 o'clock, a good time to call. Dinner would be over, and if everything was as it had always been, Bert would be putting the last of the scrub pots and pans away. Dot would gather her crossword book and a big bowl of popcorn and retire to the back porch for the evening. Mags would head out to her garden in her dirt-caked rubber shoes. Mags always spent the late evenings there, sitting on one side of a well-worn cedar bench, not gardening, not reading, just sitting. When I was a child, I tried to keep her company there, but she always shooed me away, saying she needed to be alone with her memories. My finger hovered over the number for the highway. What would happen to the house now that Mags was gone? It hadn't been a proper bed and breakfast since I was a kid. Could it be again? Should it be? When I was young, the house had been a fun, if bizarre, playhouse to explore. As I got older, I became more aware of the unusual living arrangements the house offered. It might have been a legitimate B&B at one time, but over the years, it had become a senior citizen commune with a revolving door, a long layover for people on their way to Florida retirement glory. Maybe Dot and Bert would stay on and run the place, although it couldn't have much life left in it. The house had once been a true beauty. Victorian turrets, white gingerbread trim, French doors opening up to a wide wraparound porch. But it had deteriorated over the years. By the time I left for college, it was hard to ignore the peeling paint, dislodged bricks, and window screens covered in wisteria and kudzu. Even still, no one could deny it had a peculiar charm. Somewhere in some forgotten, dusty travel guide, the hideaway was still listed as a southern sight to see. Every summer, some unwitting family would stumble in, bleary from travel, and be shocked to find the B&B was decidedly not what the guide made it out to be. Mags and the others would fuss over them and usher them up to their rooms, excited to have real guests again, convinced it was the start of the season. Somewhere in the first couple of days, the guests would inevitably cut their vacation short, saying something had happened at home and they needed to get back. Even though they couldn't wait to leave, something about the place or the people would have charmed them. They were always apologetic about leaving. It was a strange conundrum, guests fleeing sometimes in the middle of the night, but always thanking Mags for her hospitality. Aside from the true guests who came and went, the B&B was always home to a wild assortment of folks who had checked in years back and never left. Some took jobs at the house, helping with gardening or cooking, and some just lived. Mag's friends Bert and Dot Ingram had been there for decades, and Major and Glory Gregg moved in not long after them. The hideaway was always a hodgepodge of flabby arms, gray hair, house dresses, and suspenders. Good evening, the hideaway. I smiled at Dot's familiar voice. It's Sarah. Sarah, hon, I've been waiting for you to call. She put her hand over the phone and called out in a muffled voice, It's Sarah. Then she said, Vernon must have called you. I just couldn't bring myself to say it out loud. How are you? I sighed and rested my head against the back of the glider. I'm okay. How are you? Oh, you know, it all just happened so fast. Her voice broke and she paused. You'd think a 72-year-old woman would have had another decade of good living left, if not more. At least a woman like Mags. And her heart, of all things, she was healthy as a horse. Did she mention anything at all about feeling bad? Had she been having any pain? I didn't have a clue. Believe me, I've gone over this a million times in my head, Dot said. She did mention being a little short of breath a couple of times over the last week, but I blamed it on those awful cigarettes she snuck every now and then when she thought we wouldn't notice. Dot blew her nose. She had slowed down a lot since you saw her at Christmas. She just wasn't up to her usual speed, cruising around on her bike and banging through the screen door at all hours. I should have realized something was going on. Mags had sounded a little weary the last time I talked to her, but I chalked it up to normal fatigue. She was 72, after all. She must have had a hint that something was coming, though, even if we missed it, Dot said. Last week, out of nowhere, she said if she ever got really sick, we were under strict orders to pull her out of the hospital and bring her back to the house. She said she'd rather spend her evenings in her garden instead of a cold, sterile hospital room. Can't you just hear her say that? As we pulled down the driveway to go to the doctor this morning, she had the presence of mind to ask Bert to check the garden for berries because she wanted a slice of his strawberry pie. Dot's tissue crinkled over the phone. "There's no way you could have predicted this was coming." I said it as much to myself as to Dot. I wish somehow I had known, though. Maybe I could have done something. Not much you can do from 3 hours away. I could have come back for a visit to help. She never would have asked you. Regardless of what I think, she wouldn't have wanted to be the reason you left your life there for any length of time. You think differently, though? Dot sighed. I just think it was hard for her not to see much of you, even if she never said it. But we talked every week, and I came to Sweet Bay as often as I could. It'd have been different if I had more staff at the shop who could take over for me. I only have Alan. I know, you're probably right. I mentally shushed the voice in my head. Maybe it was Alan's voice, come to think of him, that asked if things really would have been different if I'd had a full roster of staff at my disposal. Would I have gone back more often? I wanted to say yes, but I wasn't sure. I had grown comfortable with the distance between Sweet Bay and me. She always told me she understood, I said. Sure she did. She was so proud of you over there. She never wanted to be a burden to anyone, especially you. You know Mags. She hardly ever asked for help, and she was private until the end. Of course Mags wouldn't have called me up and begged me to come for a random weekend. That's not who she is, or was. She wanted me to come on my own terms. I just waited too long. No sense in worrying over it all now, Dot said. How could any of us have known? She was Mags. We took it for granted that she'd be around forever. By the time we finished our call, the courtyard had emptied out. Only Millie and Walt remained, peering at each other and pondering their next moves on the chessboard. I could just barely make out the early evening sounds of Bourbon Street a few blocks away, quiet as a house cat compared to the frenzy that would ensue in the coming hours. "You're a million miles away," a familiar voice called out. "What's going on?" Bernard, an artist who lived in one of the duplexes across the courtyard, settled down in the chair next to me. He twisted off the plastic top of a dented Nalgene bottle and took a long sip. "Just watching Millie and Walt. Married 68 years and still embarrassingly in love. We watched them in silence for a few moments." "Gone out with the fellow from the law firm again?" he asked. "We've gone out a few times." A slow grin crossed Bernard's bearded face. "What's that look for?" He held up his hands in mock surrender. "I'm not saying a thing. He just appeared to have a fat wallet for someone so young." Mitch was a lawyer at one of the oldest firms in New Orleans. He made partner when he was 30, a record in the firm. Maybe even in the city. We'd been out a handful of times since he booked the chef's table at Commander's Palace for our first date, but it wasn't exclusive and definitely wasn't serious, which is exactly how it had been with most of the men I dated in New Orleans, and I was just fine with that. He's nice, believe it or not. He asked me to go with him to some gala tomorrow night, but I have to cancel. I'm going back to Sweet Bay, actually. My grandmother died. Saying the words out loud gave my new reality that I was now familyless, a weight I didn't quite know what to do with. "I'm so sorry. Were you close?" I hesitated. We were and we weren't. There was always some part of her she kept away from everyone else, including me. "So that's where it comes from."
"Where what comes from?"
"You're a private person yourself. Locked up. You don't lay all your cards out like most everyone else around here." I considered that for a moment. Maybe Mags and I were more alike than I realized. Was she a typical fresh-baked cookies and soap operas kind of grandmother? I laughed. "Not quite. Mine made the best potato chip cookies in Butler County, Mississippi."
"Potato chip cookies?" I rubbed my eyes. Now that does sound like something Mags would have cooked up. But no, she wasn't typical, that's for sure. She used to embarrass me like you wouldn't believe. Isn't everyone embarrassed by their grandparents to some degree? Come on, potato chip cookies? No one actually ate them. We just shoved them under our napkins until we could sneak them to the dog. I smiled and thought of the woman who didn't think twice about picking me up from school in a men's smoking jacket and plastic flip-flops. She walked or biked everywhere she went because of constant floaters in her eyes. When Mom and I would drive her to get her hair done, I always slumped down in my seat. With fuzzy gray curls peeking out from under a bird's nest hat, complete with baby blue eggs perched on top. Mags was oblivious to my humiliation. At least she pretended to be. But she was my only true family, probably my biggest fan, and now she was gone. I stood and squeezed Bernard's shoulder. I should get on to bed. Alan will be giddy at the prospect of running the shop for a few days without me. I need to have his instructions ready to go. Inside my loft, everything was in its place. Overstuffed down pillows on a couple of linen slip-covered couches, vintage silver vases of fresh flowers, a few tasteful pieces of artwork. I decorated the loft in the same vein as bits and pieces, although I was rarely home long enough to enjoy the flowers or the soft comfort of the couches. As I went through my usual preparations to get ready for bed, my mind was on Mags. Occasionally, she'd fluttered through the hideaway in a burst of energy, saying she was going to clean out and declutter. She'd poke through closets, check desk drawers, eye various pieces of furniture as if she'd actually had the nerve to get rid of any of it. She never did. It was as if once things or people found their way there, she couldn't bear to force them out. I, on the other hand, hated clutter and chaos, and my home and shop were evidence of that. I hadn't consciously developed a taste so different from what I grew up with, but that's how it turned out. Across the room, my eyes fell on two side chairs I'd recently refinished, but hadn't had the nerve to part with yet. I'd run across them on a rainy Saturday trek to an estate sale at a decadent, moss-covered home on St. Charles. Water dripped from the ceiling into silver buckets discreetly tucked around the opulent parlor of the 8-bedroom pre-war home. Mildewed silk curtains covered the 10-foot-tall windows. A tarnished silver-encrusted mirror hung in the downstairs powder room. It was shambles like these that had made me fall in love with the old forgotten things in the first place. I came away from the sale toting a pair of French side chairs with busted cane bottoms that now sat in my living room, proud and beautiful. My shop was full of similar rescued and restored beauties. Maybe I wasn't as different from Mags as I thought. I'd spent years all but running from her and the hideaway, but there I was, inviting other old tattered things into my life by the armful. I sat up against the bed pillows and gathered my hair into a braid to keep it neat while I slept. On the bedside table was the bottle of Jo Malone hand lotion I'd rubbed into my fingers and cuticles, the last item to check off my list before turning off the light. But tonight, I paused with my hand on the chain. Instead of pulling it, I opened the drawer of the small table and reached all the way to the back. The photo was still there, though I hadn't pulled it out in a while. Mags and my mother smiled up from the yellowed Polaroid, while I, a busy 11-year-old, laughed at something outside the camera frame and tried to bolt. My mother's hand on my shoulder was a feeble attempt to keep me in place long enough to snap the shot. I focused on Mags. The ever-present bird's nest hat was missing, and her hair, salt and pepper, heavy on the salt, was loose around her shoulders. It must have been a day with low humidity because her hair fell in gentle waves instead of frizzy curls. Her face was soft and her eyes crinkled into a smile at the corners. I'd never thought much about Mags as a younger woman, but in this photo, it was easy to peel back the years and see how she must have looked at my age, or even younger. I'd held this photo in my hands many times, but I'd never seen past her 54-year-old face into the person that she may have been before my time, before my mom's time even. As far as I knew, she'd always been the same, strange, frustratingly dowdy woman I'd always known her to be. But those eyes and her smile, it was tilted higher on one side, as if a smirk was in there somewhere, trying to sneak out. I held the photo a moment longer, then put it back in its place at the back of the drawer and turned off the light. I could feel the storm brewing. My throat burned and my eyes stung. I'd held myself together all day, but with the room dark and quiet, the tension in my chest and sadness welling in my heart overflowed. Tears spilled over my cheeks unchecked and made damp spots on my pillow. While my chest heaved with quiet sobs, I had a fleeting memory of my grief after my parents' death. It was different back then, not better or worse, just different. A 12-year-old with a grandmother and 4 live-in grandparents grieves much differently than an adult who knows she's now alone in the world, regardless of how she's tried to tell herself she doesn't really need anyone else. I rode out the storm until it ended. Exhausted and shaky, I reached over and pulled the photo out again. I propped it up against a book on the table and took a deep breath. The murky yellow glow from a streetlight outside my window illuminated Mag's face in the photo. I sank further into the pillows and closed my eyes, content to know that Mag's, wherever she was sending that half-smile my way. Chapter 4, Mags, January 1960. I was going to leave him, but he beat me to it. My bags were packed, stuffed into the upstairs closet, ready to go when the right moment presented itself. But then I found his note. I couldn't believe he left a note. Margaret, I have business in Tennessee. I'll be gone a while. Robert. As if I didn't know what his business was. Mother kept telling me to ignore everything. Of course she did. She said if I kept busy at home doing what I was supposed to do, my husband would end up back under our roof where he belonged. I took her advice through gritted teeth for most of the 3 years Robert and I had been married, but I just couldn't do it anymore. And I didn't even get the satisfaction of leaving him because he was already gone. Once everyone found out he'd gone out of town on business again, they'd surely think I left to escape the embarrassment. Eyes rimmed in red, hair a mess, vowing to do better, to be the wife who would keep him home. But I wasn't worried. No one in that town knew me very well anyway. After I read the note, I took a pencil from the drawer in the kitchen and poured myself a gin and tonic from the stash Robert never bothered to hide because he never thought I'd want to drink it. I took the drink, pencil, and note into our tidy backyard. I sipped the cocktail, thinking, massaging Robert's note in my fingers. When the glass was empty, I took the pencil and wrote, "Good riddance," underneath his words. Then I grabbed a box of matches from next to the grill and lit one. I held the note over the fire until the flames licked the bottom edge of the paper and engulfed it. I was just about to pull out of the driveway when Daddy careened down the street in his silver Chrysler, landing like a pinball in front of our house, one tire up on the grass. When he climbed out of the car, he was red-faced and out of breath, as if he'd run the whole 2 blocks from their house instead of driven. "Margaret, I'm so glad you haven't left." I hadn't told anyone I was leaving. "I know you, my dear," he said, as if he'd heard my thoughts. "I knew what you'd do as soon as Robert told me he was going away." "You talked to him?" "I was supposed to have a meeting with him at the bank today, but he called and canceled. I saw through the lie right away. If he had business in Tennessee, I would have known about it." When I opened my mouth to speak, He did instead. "I'm not here to talk you out of it. I just wanted to give you this." He handed me an envelope. "For whatever you need." "I don't even know where I'm going." He nodded. "You'll find the right place. When you come back, everything will have straightened itself out. You'll see. Some time away will be good for you." So he didn't know me that well after all, but I appreciated the effort. I took the envelope. I didn't need to open it to know what was inside. Yes, the next time you see me, things will be much different. For one thing, I wouldn't be wearing my wedding ring, although I hadn't had the nerve to take it off just yet. He took a step closer to me, still too far away to put his arms around me, but close enough to warrant some sort of physical touch. In the end, he patted my shoulder awkwardly. We stood there, two statues full of emotion, neither able to make the first move. I was always more my father's daughter than I cared to admit. Better than being my mother's daughter, though. After all, it was Daddy standing there in front of me, concerned about me. Mother was probably at home trying to come up with a reason to call me, a new recipe I needed to try for Robert since he was so tired of my tuna casseroles. I bet a good, juicy steak Diane would bring him home from the office earlier. Or maybe she found I'd skipped my camellia ball dress fitting with Mrs. Trammell, and she wanted to call and chide me. Forget the fact that I was a 22-year-old adult with my own home and husband, and I could make my own dress-fitting appointment if I needed one, which I didn't. I opened the car door, tossed my bags in the back seat, and turned to face Daddy. "I'll see you soon?" he asked. I shrugged, smiled. "What should I tell your mother?" I thought for a moment. "Tell her the truth." His version of the truth was all she needed to know. "Goodbye, Daddy." I lowered myself into the car. He put a hand on the door and helped me close it. It always stuck, something Robert promised many times to fix. The door shut with a dull thud. "Finally." "I'm gone," I said out loud. I rolled my windows down when I reached Mobile Bay. Warm air laced with the scent of just-caught fish and soft, muddy banks whipped around my face. I ripped out my hairband and let the wind have its way with me. Along the edges of the causeway, old men stood in clusters, each holding a cane pole with a line dropped into the marshy waters along the shore, a shrimp boat bearing the name Miss Carolina in sweet cursive pulled away from a dock, while a deckhand threw nets over the side. I pushed the gas down a little farther, even though Robert always cautioned me to stay below the speed limits. "There's no need to draw attention to yourself, Margaret." Funny, he never wanted his wife to be the center of attention. On the other side of the bay, I drove through the familiar towns, Daphne, Montrose, Fairhope, until I reached a deserted road lined with pecan trees and open fields. I'd gone over the bay many times with Mother, shopping for clothes or getting a bite to eat at Central Cafe. Robert and I stayed a long weekend at the Grand Hotel in the first year of our marriage, back when things were mostly peaceful and I could still close my eyes to his indiscretions. But I'd never been off the main roads and thoroughfares of the quiet over-the-bay communities. This was unfamiliar territory. The last marker I remembered seeing was one for Sweet Bay. I needed to pee. "Oh, don't be crass," Mother would say. So I began looking for a place to stop. A faded sign directed me to the Hideaway, the South's best-kept secret. The driveway was long and curved. I assumed there was a house at the end of it, but I couldn't see through the trees. My heart beat faster the farther I went down the driveway. When I emerged from the canopy of trees, I put my foot on the brake. A gorgeous old Victorian house sat bathed in the sun's last remaining rays. An old woman stood in front of the house, sweeping an oriental rug with a straw broom and yelling at a feisty black-and-white dog. The dog played a game of chase, darting on and off the rug as the woman worked. They both stopped and turned when they heard me approach. The woman directed me to a parking spot under a large oak tree. When I opened the door, she asked, "Parker, 4 nights? I wondered where you were. I thought you may have changed your plans without letting me know.
Excuse me?
Are you Parker? Mrs. Helen Parker? Double for four nights? She peered around me into the car. You're by yourself? What do you need the double room for? I have a full house tonight. I could use that double elsewhere if you can take a single. I could be anyone I wanted to be. A single would be fine. The woman told me to wait in the foyer while she got my key. Inside, people were scattered everywhere. Miles Davis floated from an unseen radio. In the large room to my left, a man sat at an easel in front of a tall window. A few others sat around him, lounging on various couches and chairs. Some smoked. One sipped on brown liquid in a highball glass. They all gestured wildly, pointing to the man's canvas and out the window. The artist laughed and flicked a bit of paint at one of the women. Down the hall in the kitchen, someone stood at the stove singing. Her back was turned, showing off dark hair hanging all the way down to her bottom. The woman came back down the hall with a key in her hand. I'm Evelyn DeBerry. I'm the owner here, and I'll give you a rundown of the rules. She glanced down at my gray-checked Christian Dior dress and black peep-toe heels. Although it doesn't look like you'll give me any trouble, she smiled at me, then gestured toward the group of people on the couches and rolled her eyes. Beatniks. I knew I looked like a dutiful housewife. It was what I was expected to look like, and I'd never questioned it. Not really, anyway. But I was no longer dutiful. I had escaped, and my sense of liberation was powerful. Now I felt more of a connection with the beret-wearing crowd on the couch than I did with Mrs. DeBerry, who sported pearls and rolled hair like mine, despite the age difference. I could feel the stares from those on the couch. Oh, how sweet! June Cleaver in the flesh, their smirk seemed to say. As Mrs. DeBerry rattled off a list of rules, I looked past her into the living room again. A man I hadn't seen at first sat among the artists. He wore dirty blue jeans and a long-sleeved plaid shirt. No beret, no cigarette, no brown liquid. But his blonde hair was long, to his shoulders. For some reason, it caught me so off guard, I had to stop myself from crossing the room to touch it. As I watched him in my peripheral vision, he turned to me. In response, my whole body turned toward him without my permission. In that never-ending moment, everything about me was reflected in his face. The way I looked on the outside and everything roiling around inside me that didn't match my appearance, it was as if I'd been hollowed out. Then the moment passed. He gave me a small smile, pulling just the corner of his mouth upward, and rejoined the conversation around him. The encounter left me disoriented. I took a deep breath to slow my heart. Mrs. Parker, are you okay? It took me a moment to realize Mrs. DeBerry was talking to me. I'm fine. I struggled to regain my composure. I glanced at the man again. His back was to us now. For all I knew, I had imagined it all. Chapter 5, Mags, January 1960. Mrs. DeBerry led me upstairs to my room. It was large and filled with stuffy antiques. A mahogany roll-top desk, a Chippendale curio cabinet, and enough occasional tables to hold a dinner party's worth of drinks. Mother would have loved it. Mrs. DeBerry stood at the door waiting, so I thanked her and told her it was lovely. Satisfied, she turned to go, then paused and stuck her head back in the door. The arty types just keep filling this place up. The worst part is they don't pay half the time. They feed me lines about money coming in. I know it's all lies, but the bills keep coming, so I have to take whoever shows up. Henry never would have let this happen. She trailed off, staring at the window. I longed to finish unpacking, crawl into bed, and disappear for a while, but I didn't want to be rude. I sat on the edge of the bed and waited. Let me know if anyone gives you any trouble. Mr. DeBerry may be gone. He passed away last year, God rest his soul, but I'm no pushover. I'll kick them out in a heartbeat if they cause any problems for a regular guest. She smiled at me like we were in this thing together, then left the room. Mrs. DeBerry had taken one look at me and lumped me in with the regular people. I knew I looked the part, but I also knew what stirred deep in my soul. I wasn't regular if it meant socializing only with those who had money and the right appearance and peering down my nose at anyone who fell outside the lines, or if it meant sticking with a marriage that had crushed any dream I ever had about what marriage could be. Not anymore. The next morning, with nothing to do and no responsibilities, I stayed in bed until 9, then made my way downstairs for breakfast. I took in more of the house than I'd seen the night before. It was grand, if a bit run down. The dust was thick on tabletops, and the rugs needed a good airing out. Cigarette smoke hung thick in the air, despite no morning appearance of the crowd from last night. Outside, Mrs. DeBerry sat at a white wrought iron table in the backyard overlooking the bay. She nursed a cup of tea, adding to it from a porcelain teapot, Limoges, the same pattern Mother had selected as my wedding china. I walked down the steps, and Mrs. DeBerry turned. "Have a seat. I'd love company." She gestured at the extra teacup, as if she'd expected me to appear. "How was your night?" "The riffraff didn't make too much noise for you, did they?" "They were fine. I slept well." "That's good. Sometimes lying in bed at night, listening to them cut up for hours, I think of how it used to be around here. Much more civilized, that's for sure." She sniffed and looked at me out of the corner of her eye. She wanted me to ask. Hearing stories about her more proper and civilized clientele was the last thing I wanted, but I indulged her. I looked out at the water as she spoke. "We bought this house as our summer home, but Henry decided to open it to paying guests when we realized its income possibilities. It took off immediately. People came from all over the South to stay for weeks at a time. Magazines used to send their editors out here at least once a summer, sometimes twice," she sighed. "It was perfect. The lawn dotted with ladies in hats and gloves, and such dashing men. Henry would take them out on the boat, and they'd come back windblown and glowing. And the dinners, oh, the times we had. Guests filled the table, and our staff served gumbo with the most succulent shrimp you've ever tasted. Fresh bread, pies so good they'd make you cry. Mrs. Parker, I wish you could have seen this place then." I smiled, but it felt stiff on my face. It sounded just like dinner parties at Mother's house, the ones she insisted Robert and I attend, if for no other reason than to show her friends we were a happy couple. "What happened?" She shrugged. "Henry got sick, and we had to stop taking on so many guests. He'd long stopped working. The house was our only source of income, and it more than paid for what we needed. But with fewer guests, money got tight. We had to let the kitchen staff go, then our cleaning staff. I'm sure your trained eye could see the state the house is in. Our old Bertha would have had an apoplectic fit if she saw how I've let things go." She refilled her teacup and mine. "After Henry died, I needed the money, so I had to be less selective about who I allowed to stay here, hence the artists," she said with a flick of her wrist. "I just don't know how long I can keep this up. I can always move back to Mobile, but I've been gone so long, I don't know anyone there anymore. If I did go back, I'd be the outsider, and I assure you I have no desire for that. Imagine me, an outsider. It's preposterous." She fanned herself with her hand, then rose from the table. "I need to get on with my day. You enjoy yourself now. I can't offer you a boat ride, but there are games in the main parlor. The artists break those out later in the day. Heavens above, I don't know how they get by in life. No jobs, no money." She continued her rant as she walked back up the steps and into the house. Alone, I breathed in the cool air. It was January, but it felt more like early spring. I leaned my head back in the chair, untroubled for the first time since learning of Robert's indiscretions. Sitting in that chair with the sun on my face, miles away from the center of the storm,
I finally felt free. I woke some time later to a man sitting at the table opposite me. I sat bolt upright, patted my hair, an automatic gesture, and smoothed my hands down my dress. "It's okay, you look fine." When I chanced a look at him, I realized he was the man from the night before, the one who stood out from the crowd. I hadn't noticed how defined his jaw was, how thick his fringe of eyelashes. He was so close, it was hard to breathe. He seemed to take up all the air in the entire world. "Pardon me for saying so, but you look a little out of place here," he said. I looked down at my dress and put my hand up to my hair again. His scrutiny reduced me to half my size. "I don't think it's me who's out of place," I said, surprising myself. He wore a flannel shirt, dungarees, and scuffed boots. "Where's your black turtleneck and beret?" He let out a soft laugh. "Touché. Your name's Helen, right?" I reached up to scratch the back of my neck. The collar of my dress felt warm and too tight. "That's right, Helen Parker." He stood and held out his hand. "Want to take a walk with me?" Under the table, my wedding ring sat heavy on my finger. I had yet to take it off. I rubbed the ring with my other fingers, considering his offer. In the end, I took his hand. And that one little decision changed everything. Chapter 6, Sarah. April. I spent Friday morning going over last-minute details with Alan. As I'd suspected, he was ecstatic about having the place to himself. No more French cafe music, for one thing. He walked around the shop, ticking items off on his fingers. "I may move some of these sconces to the back to make room for a few paintings a friend of mine dropped by. Oh, and I saw some great old masks sitting by the curb in front of the funky cat last night. I may stop by and see if I can pick them up before the garbage truck comes. They might make a nice vignette somewhere." "I'm not deeding the shop over to you. I'll be back by next Friday at the latest. I figure that gives me some time to go through Mag's things and tie up any loose ends with the lawyer. Don't think I won't notice if this place looks like a Mardi Gras float when I get back." I thought he'd tease me, as he always did, about running too tight a ship, but instead he hugged me. He'd been doing that a lot. He sniffed, and I pulled back to look at him. "It's okay, Alan. Why are you upset?" "I always wanted to meet her. The way you described her, I thought we might have been kindred spirits or something. Her having African-American roommates in the 1960s in the Deep South. If she loved people on the fringes, she would have loved me. Anyway, she was the last family you had left. Doesn't that make you the slightest bit sad?" "I'm fine, really." To avoid meeting his eyes, I turned away and straightened my dress. Alan eyed me, assessing me. I raised my eyebrows in answer. "Whatever you say." He looked at his watch. It was a couple of hours before I had to leave town. "Get out of here, finish packing, put on something comfortable, and pick up a large coffee on your way out. When you get to Sweet Bay," he affected the drawl he liked to associate with Alabama, "call me if you need me. You keep your emotions stuffed in a drawer somewhere, but your grandmother died and you're going home." Home. I hadn't thought of Sweet Bay as home in over a decade. The word unsettled me a bit. "I can get Rick to come and take over if my services are needed," he continued. Alan's friend, Rick, annoyed me, constantly misting his face with